23. We must end the age of oil. The ExxonMobil Corporation Political Action Committee invested $722,000 in candidates for federal political office during the 2008 election cycle. Despite obvious signs of a strong Democratic electoral wave building across the United States at the end of the Bush administration, the corporation's political spending remained staunchly Republican. Only 28 of the 207 recipients of ExxonMobil PAC contributions during the 2008 cycle were Democrats. In dollar terms, ExxonMobil gave just 11% of its money to Democrats. The corporate PAC gave more heavily to Republicans than did the company's employees when they made donations as individuals. Political contributions between 2000 and 2008 by individuals who declared an affiliation with ExxonMobil on disclosure forms, including Tillerson, Cohen, and other senior executives, totaled $1.22 million. Most employee contributions went to Republicans, but as a whole, employees gave more than twice as much to Democrats, as a percentage of their total, than the corporate PAC did. "We are a business-oriented PAC," an executive involved in the political spending decision said, "so we are looking for candidates who are pro-business. Now, when you apply that litmus, our PAC is rightly criticized that we tend to give more money to Republicans than to Democrats, but it is a result of the key vote system approach we take, and not a desired result." Joe Barton received more contributions from ExxonMobil than any member of Congress after 2000. Ann Northup, a Republican member of the House of Representatives from Kentucky, received the second most. Each of ExxonMobil's top 10 recipients was a House Republican. "Whoever's in power in the House has almost dictatorial power," a Washington consultant who worked on oil industry issues said. "If you control what's going on in the House, you have huge influence over the final product. Power is more diffuse in the Senate." Moreover, low-tax, free-market ideology was ExxonMobil's North Star, as a former executive involved put it, and the House Republican caucus increasingly offered the staunchest philosophical allies. "In the Senate," Ken Cohen told his colleagues in the K Street office, "it's all about the 60th vote. That is, making sure that ExxonMobil could block unfavorable proposed legislation by encouraging loyalists to invoke the peculiar Senate institution of the filibuster." From an office in Arlington, Virginia, the ExxonMobil Citizen Action Team mobilized employees and retirees to reinforce ExxonMobil's lobbying positions and favored candidates. The team maintained a toll-free information line, playing on the corporation's stock exchange ticker symbol 1-866-VOTE-XOM. It provided updates on the corporation's legislative priorities on a website and sent out glossy newsletters about pending legislation and upcoming campaigns to employees, retirees, and sympathizers. "Electing people who will pursue policies that are good for our industry and make sense for our families is an important responsibility," one of the mailings enjoined. As the 2008 presidential campaign began, however, the greatest risk that American politics posed to ExxonMobil arose from something the Citizen Action Team had trouble addressing: the corporation's general unpopularity and its attractiveness as a piñata for populists left and right. ExxonMobil had never really broken free from the reputation for ruthlessness and self-interest Standard Oil had forged during the Gilded Age. As the Bush presidency entered its final year, retail gasoline prices rose toward $4 a gallon. Quarter after quarter, higher global prices caused by Nigerian unrest and runaway Asian economic growth delivered jaw-dropping record profits to ExxonMobil. Its executives could hardly turn this cash flow off, but they had difficulty justifying it publicly in common-sense language. The problem was structural. Popular anger as pump prices spiked reflected a form of economic powerlessness among commuters and small business owners. Gasoline had become a necessity in the United States, like electricity, but its fluctuating price remained unregulated in comparison with electric rates, which could be managed up and down more gradually when underlying commodity prices changed. Moreover, when gasoline prices shot up very suddenly and without forewarning, the largest private corporation in the country, made even more money to add to its historically high profits. An American commuter or truck owner did not require socialist leanings to find this aggravating. "And how about this?" Jay Leno asked on The Tonight Show. "ExxonMobil today reported a profit last quarter, not last year, last quarter, one quarter, of $12 billion. But in their defense, that money didn't come from the gas. That's just from the mini-marts." Of all the candidates for president during the 2008 campaign, Barack Obama spoke most often and most pointedly about ExxonMobil. In debates and stump speeches, he offered none of the nuanced support for the sanctity of international oil contracts that he had voiced in private to Chad's dictator Idriss Deby while visiting N'Djamena 2 years before. Obama and his speechwriters exploited ExxonMobil's unpopularity. They called out its profits and contrasted its wealth with the struggles of American working and middle-class families coping with long commutes and soaring gas prices. Obama's spin specialists sought to link their Republican opponent, Senator John McCain, to the pro-oil policies of Dick Cheney. Politically, this was an attractive target of opportunity. In the summer of 2008, 72% of Americans surveyed had a negative view of Cheney, and only 18% saw the vice president positively. "President Bush, he has an energy policy," Obama declared. "He turned to Dick Cheney and he said, 'Cheney, go take care of this.' McCain has taken a page out of the Cheney playbook." That was campaign rhetoric. Off the trail, Obama's evolving views about energy and climate policy were subtler. He had only begun to immerse himself as a senator. It took time to grasp the nuances of automobile mileage standards, international oil supply, clean coal technologies, balance of payments issues, and the myriad ways in which different forms of energy contributed to global warming, and how the existing patterns might be altered by policy intervention or technological innovation. Obama's primary campaign involved a make-or-break commitment to Iowa, where ethanol subsidies were politically untouchable, so he embraced those with a particular emphasis on local ownership and populism. He embraced energy independence, even though he knew that it was not achievable in a literal sense, and perhaps not desirable either. But the idea sold as nationalism, especially with independent voters in swing states. There hasn't been a campaign in 30 years where the policy wonks don't cringe when energy independence comes up, but the speechwriters get the last word, said Jason Grumet, one of Obama's energy policy advisors. Obama embraced the smart version, Grumet said, in a more metaphorical than a physical sense. He knows the last barrel we use will be from Qatar or wherever it's cheapest, but he painted a bigger arc around the issue, that America can be great again, that it can renew itself.